In other words, information moves you from a vertical to a horizontal power structure.
Yes.
Yeah, and that has profound implications.
Yes, and everybody can have access to the communications, the information, and so then we need to discover what it is that we're truly drawn to, what do we really want to learn about, and that learning goes on throughout life. I think that it's not something that stops. One of the things that I was impressed with was the emphasis on education, for example, and the need to shift priorities from building prisons to educating people, and educating people, not only young people, not only changing the educational system as we know it, but to recognize that education needs to be continued throughout life, and that ignorance really is the root of our suffering, so that as we grow in understanding, we're better able to empathize with others, we're better able to act compassionately in the world, and that we really can begin to shift our priorities in such a way as people recognize what's most important.
You're, as a therapist, you can see the differences in people's attitudes or orientation about the future. And I've been struck by the how some of the people that I talk to who are very very positive, I don't mean hopeful, they're just very positive about the future, and others are very despairing and sort of overwhelmed by the burden of the breakdown. What are the psychodynamics of that way people end up seeing? I mean, part of it is the situations they're dealing with every day. And something about their feelings of potency in it to change it. Where are we? Because I can feel how deep that is as I'm talking to different people.
Well, I was impressed yesterday when Mr. Gorbachev said, "Do not be afraid of the future." And I think that really is the root of our dilemma here, that if we can face the future without fear, if we can really face the unknown without fear, because the future is unknown to us, we can see that certain trends will result in disaster if we don't change our course of direction. So it's not a matter of looking through rose-colored glasses, but to realize also that as long as we are alive, we can change. And in my work, I see people change all the time. I see people grow at all ages, at any stage of life. Often, the most dramatic growth comes out of situations of despair. It's as though we go through cycles of death and rebirth in our life. And sometimes we go through a dark night of the soul, and then new life springs up again. And this has been my experience, too, in talking to people in other cultures. For example, in people in Eastern Europe or in China who had lived under repressive regimes for a long time, and the hopefulness that still can emerge after enormous periods of difficulty and suffering is extraordinary. It just restores one's faith in the human spirit. And that's really, I think, been a great privilege for me to see how individuals go through dark times and difficult times and still are able to recover. And it's as though life springs up everywhere anew. And so I think that the key is not to despair, but to recognize that even though rationally we may feel that despair is the logical conclusion, that it's never impossible to change direction.
You're suggesting that you've seen people come out of despair into another, into a more positive orientation.
Yes.
But I guess I'm still asking about what is the genesis of somebody that has a life orientation that is one of despair versus a one of a positive one. I'm not asking how to change it at this moment or what's the optimum one to have. I'm just trying to figure out what the range of individual differences is rooted in from your professional experience.
Well, I think that despair comes from a lack of love. and that our ability to love is something that we learn, and it comes, that capacity for love can be cultivated either by inner work or in relationship, but that it requires our willingness to turn attention to it, our willingness to expand our awareness of love's presence in our lives, because it is present in our lives even though we don't notice it sometimes. Mm. And so I think that really fear of the future comes from a lack of trust in oneself and trust in the universe. I've always liked the remark that's attributed to Einstein, that if the universe were not life-supporting, we wouldn't be here. So we need to trust if we're willing to engage in such a way that maybe we can contribute to creating a better life on Earth for everyone and healing the Earth and healing ourselves, that we need to be willing to trust and to open our hearts to love and compassion.
Yeah, I have a kind of a dark Charles Adamsian image of us going under and all the people that trusted and were open and loving saying, oh, wow, look what happened after all. And all the people who were despairing saying, right, that's just the way we expected it to be. Yeah. This brings us to one of the topics you and I are very interested in, which about the future and about the unknown. Because the way in which each of us as individuals faces our own future is, I think it changes in the course of our lives. I think when we're young, we're very, very future-oriented. And as we get older, the future is a little less glowy, and there's a shift in the way we think about the future and feel about it. And do you find that as people get older, they somehow, there's a dread or there's something that happens that changes the dynamics of the way they look at life and take risk and so on?
I think it varies enormously from one person to another.
Yeah.
And that hopefully as we grow older, we can learn to live more in the present, in this moment, and that we're less concerned with fantasies about the future, or sometimes we then escape into the past. But I think that the real task of awareness is to be more fully present here and now so that we can truly give attention to what's before us rather than living in a fantasy about the past or about the future. And I think that's the challenge of learning for all of us. And so it seems to me that the young person's commitment to action and to changing the world is something that is laudable, and that the older person's willingness to simply witness and perhaps advise or share their wisdom, or there needs to be an alliance between the youth and the elders of this society in order to bring forth the optimum change in the world, because they really need each other.
That alliance is very evident in traditional societies. It's not so evident in our society.
It was very evident yesterday when the young people were saying how important it was for them to be working with the older people here, the elder statesmen, and being able to feel that they were indeed being heard and being empowered to make a difference. And the importance of mentorship was also emphasized, because that's something that is really helpful to young people, and that's something that that older people have to contribute. They have their wisdom and their experience to contribute. And that is, if they're not afraid of the future, then they have a lot to give. And so it means, again, I think that older people need to be willing to do the inner work in order to make peace with whatever stage of life they're in at the time, and then they really can enjoy their lives, no matter how old they are.
What kind of social structures could you imagine that would allow the interface between, I mean, this was an example, this meeting.
Yes.
But between young and old in a working relationship around social issues, what kind of structures could you imagine for society? Because we don't have the extended family to fall back on, which was the original way that was done.
Well, I think that we're building communities in a new way, that we really are looking at community building in many different forms these days. And I think that's healthy. I think the whole emphasis on what creates a community is very important. I think that in this week here, many people felt that we were building community, and that if we don't have the extended biological family, we have what we might call the chosen family, people that we feel closely related to because we share interests, we share some kind of affinity. And what I've appreciated about the transpersonal psychology is that it brings together people from many different backgrounds and many different cultures, and yet with a sense of shared purpose, shared meaning, and that it turns into a kind of non-local community where people who, when they do gather, they feel connected and they feel part of this community of people who are interested in transpersonal work. And yet it's not dependent on biology, it's more dependent on our shared interests. And anybody can belong to that family. And then when I think of the communications technology that allows us to feel connected to people all around the world with email and all of the various ways that we now have of communicating more easily, it's I think we need to look at different ways of building community so that anybody can participate. On the internet, for example, nobody knows how old you are or how young you are. It's a great equalizer in that sense.
Really interesting.
And
yeah.
So there is a way in which we can cross those, bridge those barriers.
There has been an assumption that people desire, just as you said, shared interests,
yeah,
that people desire to hang out with people like themselves who look at the world the way they do. And that has led to a generational breakdown because older people hang out with older people. And there are many, many communities that say no children allowed. And I can't imagine a mentoring situation coming around just through general mentoring. It would come around through old people and young people being concerned about the environment. So they'd they'd share an interest in action, and that would bring old and young together, but not just for old people to be with young people in a general way, like the family structure was.
Right.
And that's what's different.
Perhaps, but it's also true, for example, that that many grandparents are raising grandchildren now because the parents are working. So even though, and again, it's not always the biological family, but it may be in the community or in a smaller grouping of families.
Yeah.
So I think we need to look at the changing structure of the family, and that families come in many different patterns. And whether they're not, it's not always the nuclear family of two parents and one or two children. It's much more diverse, and so that people do build communities and family units that are structured in different ways these days. And I think that we need to be more open to recognizing the value of that.
If you were advising a man or a woman who has their children are grown, they've retired from their original work, they have the built-in kind of cultural distrust or paranoia about reaching out to new things, new situations, because they feel vulnerable, because they've lost a lot of their worldly power that came from being an active parent, or their roles are a little confusing to them in our society. What would you recommend to them? How would you what would you suggest they do with their lives at this point? Because a woman after menopause may have a third of her life left, an active, a healthy life. What do they do?
I think the first thing they need to do is do some inner work to begin to listen more deeply to themselves and their heart's desire, to really be in touch with what has heart and meaning for them. And that after they start looking inward and being more in touch with themselves and who they really are and what they really want and what has meaning for them, then they can discover what it is they would really want to do for the next phase of life. I think that it's not a matter of just increasing the number of leisure activities or entertainment. I think it's a matter of going deeper within in order to find something that's truly meaningful, because it's a wonderful time of one's life, in a sense, when your obligations have been completed. And if you have the means, if in retirement, for example, if you don't have to keep working in order to provide enough food and shelter for yourself, then you have a tremendous opportunity to really engage in the world in a new way, to offer service in some way that can be helpful to other people. And I think that that's what's usually the most satisfying for people, is that sense of engagement in a way that they know they're making a difference in other people's lives.